Okay, before we get started on the show, I want to remind you, don't miss Terry Gross's conversation with Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda. He talks about how making mixtapes as a teen prepared him for being a Broadway composer and how he crafts elaborate rhymes without tripping over his tongue. Also on the Fresh Air podcast, you'll find an in-depth conversation about Russia, Trump's business dealings, and segregations in schools. Lots of stuff, always fascinating, on Fresh Air. Find it on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts. From NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras. Now, this week, we're going to try something a little different. Usually, we do one topic or one artist for each week. But there's so much great music and so many amazing stories to tell that we wanted to try to pull a few of them together all at one time. You could call this a deeper dive into stories about Latinx music. And to help me this week, we have Jessica Diaz-Hurtado, Alt Latino Assistant Producer and Croc Fellow. Welcome back, Jessica.
Hey, Felix.
Okay, the first story is actually yours, and it's about something very dear to my heart, vinyl. It's a story of Chicano soul, where the sounds of the Black and Brown communities came together. The word Chicano, by the way, is a political and cultural identifier that came out of the 1960s Chicano movement, and it's a person in the United States of Mexican-American descent that reflects an identity that says, I'm not from here, but I'm also not from there. It's sort of a sense of pride. And in this piece, you dive into Chicano soul with the Chulita Vinyl Club, an all-girl vinyl collecting crew. Check it out.
There you see it. Xochitl Solis is addicted to collecting records.
I have a problem. I buy records like on a weekly basis.
She's a member of the Chulita Vinyl Club, an all-girl crew crate digging their way into the past through classic cumbias and Chicano soul. The club started in Austin, but soon followed the founder when she relocated to San Jose, California. Now Claudia Sanz scours used record shops, thrift stores, and yard sales in the Bay Area, keeping her eyes opened for records her parents grew up on.
My family's Mexican, and most of the music that I grew up with was corridos, conjunto music like Ramon Ayala, you know, Carlos y Jose. My mom listened to a lot of Los Bukis, and it was very much Mexican border music.
For Claudia, vinyl is more than just music. It's a chance to rediscover Chicano history in an old school format.
I just feel that it's definitely like more intimate than playing it like on my phone on, you know, like Spotify or a streaming app. I just like holding that piece of history.
Back in Austin, Xochitl Solis is going through her most prized records at a Chulita Vinyl Club regional meeting. The group of women gather around the living room and share their records they just bought that week.
Is this new?
Yeah.
Oh, it's on the Chicago label.
Yeah, Sonorama.
Sonorama.
So good.
I love their logo. It's like this little hand.
Xochitl is a visual artist, PhD student, and head of the Austin chapter. History jumps out at her from the music and the album cover art.
There's a little bit of archival aspect to us collecting these records, but then also sharing their stories through playing them at gigs or playing them at house parties or other events.
The records may tell a story of a community, but also of her family when she found out that Chicano soul is in her DNA.
On my father's side of the family, they were musicians, and so I was telling my dad about being in the Chulita Vinyl Club, and he was like, oh, you know, you should check out my tio Domingo. Like, he was in a band, and I was like, oh.
So Xochitl starts researching on her own, and she finds out that
my great tio Domingo, he was called Sonny Ace, and there's this great cover of Bule Bule that they did. It's in Spanish, that Sonny Ace and the Twisters. And I, you know, did a shout out to my friends in San Antonio who own a record shop. And I was like, dude, I need to have, this is my personal history. Like right here, I need to have this album, like at this 45, I want to hear, you know, my family on this vinyl. And they found one for me and sent it to me. And it's probably my most favorite that I get to play at every show, because I'm like, that's my great deal.
Her Tio Domingo, or Sunny Ace, and countless other forgotten Chicano soul singers were part of an overlooked era of rock and roll history. And collecting their records is an act of remembering that history, bringing some people back to a certain time and place.
Someone will come up to us and be like, man, I hadn't heard that song since, you know, I was in my abuela's kitchen, or, you know, things like that. And I think that there's like a real beauty there of us kind of, you know, holding on and being the conservators of this this sonic information.
And this sonic information is rooted in the 1950s and vinyl.
Well, first of all, it's just like the feel of vinyl. And I mean, just even when you hear like the little pops and clicks, you know, and stuff.
That's Ruben Molina, author, collector, and old school Chicano. He's been record collecting for over 50 years. As he combs through his collection of over 4,000 records in his Southern California home, he says that the music on those records is a byproduct of Chicano and Black communities living side by side.
What I'm really talking about is Black music, Black soul music. The Chicano became so enamorado with Black music, especially the sweet soul type of music, that it just became part of the community. Talk to me.
Enamorado. Chicanos fell in love with Black music. This connection also goes back to when Chicanos and African Americans were fighting side by side in the Vietnam War. When Chicanos came back home, they brought Black music with them. That's Little Joe and La Familia, a perfect example of soul meets Tejano. Ya todo se me acabó, no me puedo resistir. Si voy a seguir sufriendo, mejor quisiera morir. Yo voy vagando en el mundo sin saber a dónde ir. Little Joe, or José María de León Hernández, and his real family were raised on the cotton fields of Texas, alongside Black families. According to music historian Ruben Molina, this mix of blues, soul, and Tejano traveled with Mexican farmworker families as they followed the crops through Texas, Tennessee, and up to Minnesota.
So these bands would go kind of follow that group of people and perform, you know, at bars, at dance halls, and concerts out in the fields and stuff like that.
And that is what fascinated Molina, so much so that he wrote a book in 2007 called Chicano Soul, Recordings, and History of an American Culture. He self-published only 200 copies, but apparently captured the sociological and musical connection so well that the few copies that exist on Amazon sell for hundreds of dollars. He's going to republish his book, a collection of stories about forgotten artists that inspire memories of abuelas, of coming back from war, of cross-cultural moments. And one of those stories is Dimas Garza, an old-school Chicano soul singer. All I do is
cry. When I first heard his record, first of all, I thought he was Black, because the record just says Dimas, doesn't say Dimas Garza. But once I seen the Garza and I figured out he's from San Antonio, I went looking for him just because I liked his music so much, you know. And I went down and I met him. He was a carpet layer with this beautiful voice, man. And, you know, he was in his 60s and we talked, and then he sang, and I was like, whoa, this is this beautiful voice.
Molina organized a show in L.A. and brought Dimas Garza out to perform. Imagine un viejito singing songs he wrote decades ago. But then, the inevitable happens.
He passed away. He passed away as soon as people were like discovering him. But you know what? I mean, he would have died as a carpet layer.
And instead, he died a singer.
I know your love can do so many things. I feel so blue when you're not there. I'm lost, I know, when I'm without you. My heart just breaks when I'm without you.
That was a very touching and profound story that covered a lot of bases and a lot of history. That was very, very good reporting on that story.
Thank you. And now we're going to change the energy just a little bit. This next story is about Tucson musician Sergio Mendoza. He's known for his loud, high-energy, sweaty live shows and for creating a sound that incorporates elements of music from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. His band, Orquesta Mendoza, released an album last year called Vamos a Huarachar that continued the story of his band's growth. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Sarah Ventry spoke with Mendoza about that record and how growing up on the border influenced his music.
I was born in Nogales, Arizona, but then I was raised in Nogales, Mexico. For the kind of music that we play, we try to incorporate different cultures and traditions from both sides of the border. Just, I mean, my experience here in Arizona, it's been mainly positive living here. You know, as I grew up, I never thought of people in colors or race. And there's been certain situations in Arizona where certain people have made me aware that I am Mexican and that I'm a little darker. And overall, I wouldn't describe Tucson as a racist place or try to promote it like that in any way. But, you know, I've had experiences and that's what makes you who we are, you know.
So do you in some ways see your music as reactionary to the politics that are happening around you, or are they just incidental? Is it that you're making this music despite whatever is happening in the world around you?
I mean, when I lived in Nogales, I think it was more like making music for making music, and that's where it starts. But the more I tour the world with other bands, with Calexico or Divachka, these are bands that are aware of social issues. And for me now, I want to be more aware of what's happening in my city, in Tucson and Phoenix and in my state. And it's only from experiences that now the themes of the songs have a little bit to do more with these topics like race and my feelings about that.
Can you point to maybe a couple of songs on your new record that you feel like are reflective of some of those themes?
Well, track number 2, it's called Redoble, and that's a song that it sounds like it could be a party song or it could be like a good dance number, but it's mainly about my experience with seeing racism. And so the song is called Redoble, which Redoble means drum fill in Spanish. And it also says Vamos a Huarachar, the album title. And the way I look at that is, drum fill leads you to the next section in the music, but I'm kind of more referring to a change in the way things are here. And Vamos a Huarachar is kind of like an invitation to anybody in our state to come in and dance with us and to come and celebrate different cultures coming together here in Arizona.
Thank you.
For someone who has never been to one of your live shows, it's a pretty incredible experience. Like, I almost feel sometimes when I have stepped into one of your shows that I'm stepping into a different place or maybe a different time. You're all wearing suits. You're set up on stage, maybe kind of like in the way a big band would have been set up in the 40s or 50s. Everyone's dancing and moving and sweaty. How do you create that energy on stage at your live show? And then how do you translate that kind of intense energy where you're feeding off of the crowd onto one of your studio albums?
Well, for the live shows, if it was up to me, I would have 50 musicians all dressed the same and looking sharp, you know. I think that's really important for me to present it that way, in the way of a band from the 1940s with the big bandstands and everything. Then as far as the energy of the band, for this record that we just made, Vamos a Huarachar, we constructed the songs in the studio. It wasn't a band playing all these songs together. It was recorded in sections. And so I think it's hard to really represent the sound of the band in the studio. But then at the same time, I think it's really cool that we make these studio versions, and then the live show has a lot more energy and it's different than the studio album.
One of the things that I think is so appealing about your music is that it comes from so many different places. You can hear so many different styles as part of it. You can hear cumbia, you can hear mambo, psych, rock. You can hear so many different things. Did you grow up listening to all of those styles of music, or did you come to them later?
Well, I've been into many different styles of music throughout my entire life. And then, there's styles that I didn't like when I was a little kid and I like now. But when I was little, I mainly started with the traditional border music, you know, there in Nogales, Sonora, which included a lot of cumbias and rancheras and, you know, all the traditional styles like Ramon Ayala, Los Tigres del Norte. Those are some of the first melodies I started to learn on keyboard when I was 5. And of course, I discovered the Beatles right around the same time. And then, when I came to Nogales, Arizona, I started playing with musicians who were, you know, born and raised in Nogales, Arizona, and they got me away from Mexican music. And to them, it was like, even Mexican television, they were like, why are you watching Telemundo, or why are you watching, you know, it was like, watch this channel in English and listen to Led Zeppelin, Police. So then, from when I was like 11 through 18, it was just all American music. And then when I was like 23, I started playing salsa. So I joined a salsa band, and I did that from like 24 to 27. And salsa was actually like the connection that got me back to loving Latin music, because I had been away from it for a long time. And after playing salsa, I wanted to go back to what I heard when I was a little kid, which was mambo. And that's what led to me starting Orquesta Mendoza. I mean, this new record, it's a combination of a lot of things. Of course, with Latin rhythms overall. But there's references to the Beatles, to the Zombies, and to all the bands that I like.
That was Sarah Ventry from member station KJZZ in Phoenix.
You know, I met Sergio at South by Southwest a few years ago.
What?
And we sat down for about an hour, and we talked about his love for big band mambo, but also his wide scope of appreciation for music of all kinds. So it's great to hear that on that record. It was great to hear that report. The annual South by Southwest Music and Film Festival just finished its sprawling 2-week run in Austin, Texas. Now, last week we talked about music here on Alt Latino, so this week we're going to talk film. You know, having a small indie film selected to premiere at South by Southwest can really give it a gigantic boost by introducing it to film distributors, critics, and fans. Now, this year, I had an opportunity to view a film made by a pair of first-time Tejano filmmakers from South Texas. As I Walk Through the Valley is a film about the underground and above-ground music scene in the Rio Grande Valley. If the Valley, as it's known, gets any attention at all, it's usually for all the wrong reasons. The fear of violence from just across the border, drugs, human trafficking, the wall. So Ronnie Garza and Charlie Vela made a film to tell a different story. They are themselves musicians from the Valley, and they wrote, produced, edited, and co-directed the film. And it's really more like a love letter to the musicians and fans of South Texas who have for decades created a one-of-a-kind music scene that most people don't know of unless they live there. Like me, I was really knocked out by stories of musicians and audiences who kind of feel out of the loop of the national music scene simply because of geography. Go ahead, take a look at the map. The Valley is the southernmost tip of South Texas. But from 1960s garage rockers to social movements of the 1970s fueled by ranchera music, all the way through South Texas punks wearing lucha libre masks and slam dancing, Ronnie Garza and Charlie Vela did a great job of telling their story in this must-see film. Again, it's called As I Walk Through the Valley. I caught up with both of them at South by Southwest just after their final screening, and I started by asking them to identify themselves so we can tell whose voice is who.
My name's Charlie Vela. I'm one of the co-directors of As I Walk Through the Valley.
And my name is Ronnie Garza, the other one.
But first of all, why did you make the movie?
Well, nobody else is going to make the movie.
And what was significant about, you know, the storyline? What was it that wasn't getting told?
What was it, though? Nothing was being told about that music at all. The only thing that's being told about the Valley currently is bad information. Stuff about corruption, stuff about crime, stuff about the border being dangerous, and just lots of mischaracterizations. And we think that some of the most interesting aspects of it are that these bands got together, pulled what they could do, pulled everything, you know, their resources together, and just try to create their scene and entertain, you know, their community.
I think what's fascinating about it is that it's generational, you know, as you guys discovered. And tell us a little bit about that, because you had one idea when you started with, but then as you started to like peel back the onion, so to speak, you started discovering other things, and it actually went back in time.
In the 1960s, you have kids raised on regional music saying, I want to do funk music, or I want to do rock and roll music. And then you have kids in the 70s saying, well, I don't want to pretend like I'm white. I want to embrace what makes me Chicano. And they do their own kind of music. And then you have kids, their kids say, like, well, I don't want to do what my parents did. So I like metal and hardcore, and on and on and on. It's just part of what it means to be youth, or part of what it means to have youth culture, is like, you want to tear down what came before and you want to make your own thing. And it just happens to take different turns in the Valley than it does at other places.
And that's one of the aspects, too, about the film that I think is pretty strong, is the idea of identity and answering that question, where do I fit in?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting aspects about the movie is the earlier generations definitely have a stronger foothold in Spanish language culture. And as the region is growing and urbanizing rapidly, you have this sort of loss of all of that. And the new crop of kids, especially from the 80s on, are very much English language and English language culture. And they're trying to just play on the same level as anybody else in the United States. And that's sort of like, I think, their high water mark. They want to pass. They want to be just as good as whoever, like Metallica at the time, or, you know, later on, whoever it may be, if it's Radiohead or At the Drive-In, whoever it may be. I think the later generations really kind of gravitate to that. And you see that sense. And I think it's also an open question. Like, what is the musical identity of the region? What's the musical fingerprint? And we do a lot of showing and not telling. I think it's still an open question to explore.
Okay, the film is about music, but the various kinds of music through the decades is also an exploration of culture and how it is expressed in the valley.
There's no monolithic valley experience. So there are people who are raised very deeply steeped in Mexican-American culture, Mexican culture. There are people who are raised very cut off from it. And these are the reasons for this are like very varied. There was a time when the region was almost completely controlled and white-owned. I mean, all of the people in the school boards, in the city governments, in the police departments were all Anglo, all the landowners. And as that power structure kind of turned on its head throughout the 70s, we're trying to find different ways to sort our identity or individuality. And for people who are living very close to the border, sometimes that means looking as far away from where you are as you can. You want to prove that you're just like everybody else. Whereas if you're in a larger urban center or somewhere further north of the checkpoint in Falfurrias, I mean, your Mexicanness, your Chicanoness, like, gives you kind of like social cash. It makes you individual, so people are quicker to embrace it in places that are geographically far away from the border.
And so, yeah, I think there's like this gravitational kind of force in other cities like San Antonio or Houston, even Dallas, that reinforces the culture. Whereas down here, the push is very much don't speak Spanish. You need to get a job, you need to do American things. Like, that's what, we're Americans, we do American things.
The checkpoint creates a concentration of people who live in the region who are kind of like, all look the same and all have the same, similar last names, and it's a phenomenon that you don't see in a lot of other parts of the country. There's, you know, it, like Ronnie was saying, it's an open question, so there's like a push and a pull, and especially younger kids today are trying to piece together a hybrid identity, maybe with a break in the passing down of traditions. So they maybe weren't taught Spanish as children, but they're trying to pick up slang, and they're trying to, you know, find things that they can craft together into something that's them or for them.
I don't think I've ever seen so many Chicanos in one film. And, you know, and I'm 59 years old, bro. You know, and I've been going to movies since, you know, Walt Disney. Yeah. I have never seen so many Chicanos in one film.
And actually, one of the things I've been very cognizant of while we're watching is in the early parts of the film, there's a lot fewer Chicano people. I mean, like, there's a lot more Anglo kids because at that time in the 1960s and beyond, I mean, there's like, it's a socioeconomic thing. If you don't have the means to preserve yourself, your image, your music, you know, a photograph or film or whatever, it's like you never existed. One of the really cool things that we got access to was this deep archive of photographs of the valley all the way through the 1940s and the 1930s. And one of the things you notice is, like, you would never know that Mexican people lived there because they couldn't afford to have their picture taken all the time. And so it's like, it's this, it's something that while we're making the movie, I started becoming aware of, and that, like, as people get more and more access to technology and people, you know, the kind of the democratizing nature of, like, being able to tell your own story, record yourself, film yourself, take photos of yourself, it's a more accurate representation of kind of the balance between, like, the Anglo community and the Mexican community. And really, it's like border community, which is like its own thing.
Okay, we're talking about this movie and we're getting you interested. So how can you see it? Well, it's a little complicated.
We have no distribution at all. We'd like to get that. You know, for folks who are listening, you know, write your congressman. I don't know exactly how you do it. I'd search it on Netflix, maybe. Request it on Netflix. We're artists, right? So we needed to make this movie. We felt like we had to tell this story, and we're now trying to understand how we get it out to everybody. So that's the next step.
And really, before the film came out, we came out with the trailer for the film almost 2 years ago. This is a 3-year project that we've been working on. It's mainly a 2-person operation. So all of these kind of like deeper, like, industry technical things, I mean, this is something you learn as you go. And also, like I was saying, when we released the trailer, a lot of people made like assumptions about what the movie was. People were putting a lot of stuff on what the story was going to be.
And I thought it was like a punk documentary, and that was it. But it's more like a history.
Yeah, and so now that people are actually starting to see the film at this festival, we're going to be debuting it in the hometown very shortly, this movie is really for those people and people who have never really seen themselves or their stories represented. Beyond that, it would be wonderful if people who are interested in hearing stories like this were asking, like, why is this not in a place where I can see this? Why is this not on Netflix? Why is this not on, you know, some streaming service or where I can get access to it?
You know, in this age of social media, Hollywood just may pay attention. So think about writing to your favorite streaming service and asking about it. Because after having seen it myself, you know, I really enjoyed it for its great cultural experience. And it's also a statement about giving an accurate portrait of just one segment of our collective Latino identity.
And you know, as much as it's for the Valley, it is also for the rest of the nation, because we have this bad rap. Because we have this sort of like, the White House itself is looking for putting out a list of immigrant crimes and stuff. There's just way too much negative spin on our people and our region. And so we definitely want to get it in front of everyone else, because it shows that we're not the other anymore. Like we're like the same, especially the later generations. We're the same as you guys. The scariest, you know, thing in the world. We're not the other, we are you.
We hope you heard something you liked in this week's show.
And that you heard a story that made you want to hear more music.
We want to remind you that you can hear all the music we play today on our website at npr.org/altlatino.
And we'd love to hear from you about this news magazine-styled format. Did you enjoy it? Would you like to hear more stories in this format? Drop us a line on Facebook and Twitter. We are NPR's Alt Latino.
Jessica Diaz-Hurtado, again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Felix Contreras. This has been Alt Latino.